Now, tonight I've got a very short life. I'm afraid I have so much material about it, I have a job to keep what I have to say short, but it is the life of Henry Martin, spelt with a Y, 1781 to 1812. So you see, he only lived a bare just over 30 years. And is a rare kind of life, because there is nothing startling or spectacular or exciting about it. But all we gain, all the information we gained, is taken from his diaries. He never wanted them published, he wanted them destroyed, but they were published, thankfully, and all the quotes and the information I have from reading his journals. And so the life of Henry Martin can help us. Now, for young people, one little word of warning. It's very, very tempting when you hear the life of some unusually great believer to try to copy and to imitate them. That is not what they are for. None of us will be a Henry Martin. But if you are keen to give your life to the Lord Jesus and keen to devote your life to him, it will encourage you to read about somebody who did that far better than you or I will, but it will perhaps encourage us in that way. So I'll have to skip over much of his childhood, his boyhood in Truro in Cornwall, born into a family where everybody died young. They were all prone to TB, and few of them reached the age of 40. He himself was, as a boy, very, very lively and precocious, very clever, and because he was rather weak physically, bullied at school, the school mercifully spotted it, and they put him in the care of an older boy, a certain John Kempthorne. And you see the providence of God in these things. John Kempthorne was a believer, a Christian, and he had charge of young Henry at school. They put Henry in for Oxford at the age of 15 because the school thought he was bright. He was bright, but not quite bright enough. He failed. In the providence of God, he got into Cambridge 2 years later. He was a classical scholar. Truro Grammar School was noted for its classical scholarship. And he won a place at Cambridge, but he changed to maths. His father loved maths, and he had one burning ambition. He wanted to win the position of what then, well, I think now still, was called the senior wrangler position. The senior wrangler was the finest mathematician of the whole year. In fact, probably in the country of that age group. And he hoped that he, by hard work, would gain that coveted prize. He did. He worked so hard, he drove himself so hard, that he had the reputation in the college of being the man who never lost an hour. Now, he was of a very sensitive nature, tremendously sensitive. It's hard to explain how. On one occasion, he got engaged with an argument with a fellow student, and he seized his knife and hurled it at him. Mercifully, he missed, and the knife was left quivering in the wooden panelling just beside his friend's head. He was a person who felt with intensity, and that kind of intensity was later turned by God to be devoted to his service. Well, now, he was not a Christian when he went to Cambridge, but there were different factors at work in the providence of God. Three people were praying for him. John Kempthorne, providentially, was in the same college. He was actually senior wrangler of an earlier year, and he prayed for young Henry. His sister Sally was praying, his father was praying, and he wasn't praying. He resented their prayers. He was harsh and bitter when they pleaded with him about the gospel. And later he was very, very broken-hearted about the way he treated his family. It was only his father's death that moved his heart. And then he began to realize just what his father had gone through. Well, God never let him go, and he found his way into Trinity Church, Cambridge, to hear Charles Simeon. Charles Simeon was a very faithful evangelical Anglican preacher who preached in Cambridge for 50 years, despite mockery from the university authorities, the clergy, and the open mockery of the students. Young Henry came to listen to Charles Simeon, and God worked in his heart. He doesn't know himself when or how he was converted, but suddenly he realized that his life had been turned around. And he said, "The whole current of my desires is altered. I'm walking another way." And he was indeed. Well, 3 years passed, and the day came when he and the finest of the students at Cambridge were in the Senate House sitting for the mathematical position of senior wrangler. He was agitated. He by now was a Christian and was anxious about this. As he sat down, a verse of the Bible came to him: "Seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not." And taking that as from the Lord, he sat down and committed the whole issue to God, and in the providence of God, he won the position of senior wrangler. He didn't actually allow it to affect him. He still remained the same Henry Martyn that he was before. He was still as sensitive, as lively. In fact, he had a charming, vivacious personality, which never left him all his life. Even in his converted days, he was a lovely pattern for a young Christian. But now, of course, his whole system of priorities has changed. He sat down for the exam. He gained the position of senior wrangler. And in his diary he wrote, "I obtained my highest wishes, and I was surprised to find I had grasped a shadow." And he realized that those who drink of the water of this world thirst again. What he had been striving for was not really worth the effort. But by now his name was made for scholarship. He actually then changed over to classics and was soon the finest classical scholar in the University of Cambridge. He was made a fellow of his college at the age of 21 and the examiner for Latin for the university at about the same age. But things had changed in three ways. The company he kept had changed, his witness had changed, and his personal life had changed. Now, he saw that Christians were the only company really to cultivate, and there were young men at Charles Simeon's church, and he cultivated their company. By nature, he was the kind of person who did not like offending people. He didn't like witnessing for his faith. But he realized that now he must. In his diary again, he says, "May the Lord fix it in my heart that I am among dying souls who are thronging on their way to hell." And so, though it was very, very difficult, he began to witness to those he knew. And in his personal life, he changed. Now, private prayer and Bible reading became a delight, rising early to be with God, memorizing the scriptures, and above all, searching his own heart, again in his diary, "Reveal to me the evil of my own heart, O thou heart-searching God." He was a different person, but something else changed. A new ambition had taken him over. He had come across the diary of David Brainerd, the young American who gave up everything to work among the American Indians and died at the age of 30. And he felt a conviction in his own heart that this is what God was calling him to do. Not the American Indians, but he was interested in the people of India. Charles Simeon probably had put this into his mind. And so in his early 20s, he set about preparing. He was ordained as a curate in the Church of England, and then he began as a curate under Charles Simeon. The college authorities thought he was mad. In fact, everybody at Cambridge thought he was mad, throwing up such a career to live in poverty and to die without having achieved anything. But he knew what he wanted to do. He began by serving locally. You know, when we want to serve, we don't need to go across the sea to serve. And he began where he was, witnessing in the workhouses, in the almshouses, in the hospitals. He found it very, very distasteful because he's a very sensitive, neat person, and to be in this company was very hard for him, but he made himself do it, praying with the poor and the dying, warning the careless, spending hours trying to help those who were deprived. And so he went on preparing his life for missionary service. There's just two things in the way. The first was money, and the second was marriage. He had no finance. He'd hoped his father would finance him. His father was dead, and there was nothing in the family estate to finance him. And he realized that if he were to go to India, he would have to be paid to go, and so he went as a chaplain to the East India Company. He had another obstacle, marriage. He was deeply in love with a young Cornish woman of his own age, Lydia Grenfell, and she responded. She could not go to India. Her widowed mother couldn't stand the separation, and he knew his work would be better for a single man. And they both made the sacrifice. He went. They never met again on earth, though they corresponded. And so it was that in 1805, at the age of 24, he left England for the last time. He went as chaplain to Nelson's fleet, transporting 5,000 troops to India. Very, very painful. He said it was like dying, leaving everything he loved forever. 9-month journey. It was a mini mission field in itself, preparation for the hard labor that was ahead of him. The fleet was, there was quite a large fleet for the number of troops involved, but in practice, though he was the official chaplain, he was limited to his own ship, the Union. His flock consisted of officers, sailors, and soldiers. The officers reviled him. The men, rough and hardened soldiers, sailors, hated him as much as the officers. They hated his faithful reproof of their profane oaths. They hated his pleadings and his warnings. He said he was lonelier than he'd ever been in his life. And hardly any response for his work. Just a few. The chief mate stopped swearing and became his chief supporter. And there were five who daily would find their way to his cabin for prayer. And so he had a little fellowship, but otherwise he was very, very much on his own. His messages were hated, but they couldn't deny his love. It must have been a very strange sight. It was to them. They couldn't make it out. But there below deck, in the heat and the stink of the conditions below the decks, there was this neat figure, the ex-Cambridge Don, in his neat black suit, going around tirelessly from hammock to hammock with medicines and food and the gospel. Yes, they couldn't deny his love. The last day came when they were approaching India, and he preached his last sermon. You might have thought that at least there would be a little softening, but no. Those who had reviled him to the very last, mocking his words. It pained me, he wrote in his diary, but such is the unthankful office of a minister. I desire to bear the ridicule of men, looking forward to another world for my approval and reward. Well, India, 1806 to 1811, he was 25 when he landed. I think we might have the map on now, Sam, just to... He landed, actually, you can ignore the blue line for now, he landed at Calcutta. There was the headquarters of the East India Company, who ruled India under British government supervision. He found India to be total darkness, whether it was the darkness of Hinduism or the darkness of the British community with their corruption, their idleness. He had one relief, and that was the warm welcome of David Brown, the senior Anglican chaplain, a very, very godly man. And Martin's official work was to Europeans, to the British troops and the European community. He longed to reach the native Indians, but he wasn't allowed to. The East India Company was bitterly opposed to missionary work, and so he had no brief to go among the Indians. But David Brown realized that he wouldn't be able to keep him much longer. A man like Henry Martin would be sure to want to leave Calcutta and go among the Indians. And so he, in due time, was given a post a little further away. But he preached his first sermon before all the important people of Calcutta. At once there was a storm of protest from all the other chaplains of Calcutta. He took the text, "We preach Christ crucified," and there was a fury aroused. He was denounced, he was preached against, he was vilified. Such sermons, they said, were for the heathen, not for English people. The only support he had was from David Brown, who was his protector at this time. And, of course, he had fellowship across the river with the trio at Serampore, William Carey, Joshua Marshman, and Ward, at the community, the Baptist community there. He had good friendship with them. You can't see it on here, but Calcutta was on the one side of the river, and Serampore was a Danish colony on the other side where the Baptist community were settled. Now, David Brown supervised his being transferred up the river to the first place where he was to stay. Patna is on our map, you can see it there, was his first station. Here he was to be chaplain to the British troops. And so he went up this quite a long journey up river. It was actually 350 miles up the river Ganges, a journey of 6 weeks. He wasn't a man to waste a moment. These weeks were weeks of tireless labor. Every day was spent in translating the New Testament into Hindustani and giving tracts to everybody he met, trying out his stammering Hindustani on the crowds who came to see this unusual sight of a white stranger. And so he began his work immediately. For Martin, time was short. He realized he would have a short life, and he realized here were millions of people who had never, ever heard the gospel. And so every single person he met was somebody for him to preach Christ to. He was still what he was at Cambridge, but now in a different sense. He was the man who never lost an hour. And now, Patna was then India's fifth city. Had no church, no gospel. And nearby at Dinapore was his destination, the British camp. 2 regiments, numerous camp followers. And there for the next 2.5 years, he had to act as chaplain to the community. It was just like the sea voyage all over again. The Europeans, the soldiers, the officers hated his message. The Indians hated him because he was English. Everything was heathen. There was no God, no church, no gospel. He persevered. There was the official church parade in which he preached to the men in the open air, men fainting in the heat. There was a hospital where his kindness touched those who could not hardly take his message. And then every night after dark there were the secret meetings where the few from the camp who had the courage would gather to meet with him. At first there were 6 of them, and before he left there were 30, as they gradually grew bolder in their witness. And then there was the children's work, and this for him was really the part of the work he did at Dinapore. It was the key to reach the people, because he had parts of the New Testament in Hindustani, and so every moment he worked among the boys and girls. He had 5 schools before he left, and that plus his work as chaplain would have, I suppose, taken up enough time for most of us. But then every spare moment was used in translating the rest of the New Testament into Hindustani, working in conditions rarely below 100 degrees from early morning to late at night. It was lonely work, no visible result. He would have been despondent, he said, if it were not for one conviction, the omnipotence of Jesus Christ, his Saviour. Well, in 1809, he was ordered upriver to Cawnpore. It doesn't seem far there, but it's another 300 miles up the Ganges. Hotter, drier, dustier still than Dinapore. It was April, when Europeans never risked their lives by travel. He did, driven by his desire to begin his new work. He was carried in a palanquin for 2 days and nights without resting. The air was hot as an oven, and they were passing over a terrain where there was not a blade of grass, there was not a cloud in the sky, and he arrived at his new destination more dead than alive. But at once he began where he left off at Patna. There was a church parade before sunrise, men fainting because of the heat. It was the same story. Once again, hardly any response, just the secret few. But now something else opened up for him, which was more after his heart's desire. His work among the beggars. He was still the man who never lost an hour, and he realized that he had an opportunity. He announced that one day a week, every Sunday, there would be food. And so there came beggars of every kind, the so-called holy men, or just the destitute, young, old, male, female, addicts of every kind. Food was given. While they ate, he preached. He preached creation. They applauded. He denounced the folly of worshipping the sun and the moon. The Muslims applauded. The Hindus groaned and hissed. He preached judgment and repentance. They were all silent. He preached Christ, the Son of God. And he feared that it was a total waste of time. There was no result, but he was wrong. Standing by, curious, was an influential Muslim, a certain Sheikh Salah. He came to mock, but he was impressed by what he saw. He read the New Testament. Later, he was converted and baptized, and he took a new name, Abdul Masih, the slave of Christ. Martin never lived to see this fruit, but that man became a much-used gospel preacher among his own people. But he could not go on like this. He was working tirelessly from early till late in temperatures never below 100 degrees. His friends realized that his time was short, and so David Brown arranged for his recall to Calcutta, because now a new need was becoming evident. The great need was not his preaching, but his ability to translate. And they realized that this could be done far, far better in Calcutta than in the fearful conditions under which he was working. And so, after these few years upriver, he is back again in Calcutta. Now, Henry Martyn was a born linguist. And in England, while at Cambridge, he had been a prominent classical scholar, Latin, Greek, Hebrew. In fact, any language fascinated him. They said he had read grammar of other languages with the eagerness with which other people read novels. But deeper down, something else drove him to study languages with such an intensity. It was simply that he was now in India, where there were millions of people who could not read scripture in their own language. And he longed to make known to them the word of God. And so from the moment he arrived, in fact, even on the boat before he got there, Hindustani took up all his spare time, learning to speak it, to preach it, and to translate the scriptures into it for the native population. And he succeeded. It was a superhuman task, but in the 2 years he'd been there, in less than 2 years, he had at Dinapore, he had actually translated the whole of the New Testament into the Hindustani. His Hindustani New Testament was actually the standard text for the next 50 years. His accuracy as a translator was such, and his ability to pick the right language, simple enough for the simplest reader, and yet faithful to the text, the original text. And so his Hindustani New Testament was his first translation. When you think that it was done on top of all his other preaching in temperatures, often in the hundreds, it was an amazing exploit. But now he and his friends saw another need. Arabic was the language spoken from Africa to China, and Persian was spoken by millions, and they had no New Testament in Arabic and Persian. He'd already begun to study these, along with Hebrew and Sanskrit, but now, realizing that his time on earth was short, he knew that the translation into Arabic and Persian were his two priorities. So David Brown found him two scholars to help him, men who spoke Arabic and Persian. They were a strange pair. The first, they're both Muslims, but the first was an agnostic. He believed nothing. And though for 2 years he worked along with Henry Martyn on the scriptures, at the end he was still as unbelieving as ever. The second, Nathaniel Sabbat, was a strange person. He was a professing Christian, but despite his profession, he was, says Henry Martyn, an unchanged child of the desert. Slightest criticism of his work brought outbursts of rage. His pride was unbearable. He genuinely believed that he was divinely inspired and his translations must be word perfect. And yet Martin loved him as a Christian brother and was gentle to that proud, unpredictable Arab, so that when he later spoke of him, Sabbat said he was more of an angel than a man. And so by tremendous labor, with the help of these two scholars, the Persian and the Arabic New Testaments were completed. And then came a blow they had never anticipated. They were submitted to scholars in Calcutta, and the verdict was that there were so many flaws that they would be useless. Sabbat's Arabic grammar was poor, and his Persian was too full of Arab Arabian idiom for any Persian to want to read it. And Martin realized, and David Brown and his friends realized, that the only possible way to get a good Arabian, Arabic and Persian translation was to go to these countries and do it in the native country. They must visit both Persia and Arabia and do the work there. And so Martin moved. He had to move from where he was last, which was up at Cawnpore, wasn't it, back to Calcutta to see David Brown. And then after they had discussed it together, they realized that he must go abroad himself now and do this work. They decided that the Arabic would have to wait. The Persian New Testament was the urgent need. And so on the 7th of January, at the age of 30, Henry Martin left by ship from Bombay en route for Persia. And that's the blue line that you see there. He leaves Calcutta and he goes round to Bombay and then on to the Gulf. The voyage was for him a health cure. His fellow passengers were titled English gentlemen, high officials in the empire. His testimony actually impressed them, and I was interested in this because you might get the impression that Henry Martin was a recluse, a person difficult to get on with, somebody who would live very much cut off from his fellow men, but it wasn't so. The testimony of one of these high officials, Sir John Malcolm, in a letter to the English ambassador said, "His knowledge of Arabic is superior to any man in India. He is a learned and a cheerful man, a great enthusiast for his holy calling. I'm sure you like him. He will make you say grace before and after dinner, and if anyone takes the Lord's name in vain, he'll admonish them. But his good sense and his learning will delight you. He was evidently a man of charm, so that even though he was a very strict Christian, he never alienated people by forcing his views upon them. He was good company," was the verdict of all these people who mixed with him. It's something for, I think, young Christians again. Don't try to be too pious and force your opinions on other people. Let your life shine more than your words. Well, he reached the Gulf in May 1811, the hottest season. No place for a sick man, and he was a sick man. Here he put on Persian clothes, complete with the huge conical head attire made of sheepskin with the wool on. He'd grown a beard and a moustache, and if you saw him sitting on a Persian carpet with no furniture, eating without a spoon or a plate, you would never have recognized the fellow of St. John's College, Cambridge. Then began the journey. The journey from the coast to Shiraz, in a convoy of 30 horses, was a 10-day nightmare. That's the first stage of that journey, the dotted line there. They travelled at night. The daytime heat of 126 degrees made sleep impossible. There were mountains to cross where the cold at night left them shivering. There were mosquitoes and scorpions and precipices. There were threats of robbers. And how he survived was almost a miracle. But at last, gasping for life almost, with the double heat of an inward fever and the burning sun above, they arrived at Shiraz, a wonderful white city of gardens and fountains in its own lush valley, the Oxford and Cambridge combined of Persia, the home of Muslim scholars and poets, the seat of Persian literature and learning. He knew nobody, but he had a letter from Sir John Malcolm to a wealthy citizen, a certain Jaffa Ali Khan. Now Shiraz was the stronghold of the Shia sect of Islam, and here he was alone for almost a year, a solitary Christian, no fellowship, no church, no companion in prayer, just day after day at work on translation. He was there from June 1811 to May 1812. He caused quite a stir when he came. To some he was a heretic and a spy. The boys stoned him. The prince's nephew threatened him with a sword. But generally he aroused curiosity. His work was constantly interrupted by inquirers. He turned nobody away. Patiently he listened and answered and teach. And the interest was so great that the leading mullah printed a defense of Islam in case he undermined the faith of the faithful. And he in return printed a reply. Twice he found himself in public debate with the leading teachers. Always he turned the discussion to one subject, which to him was the key to all discussion, the deity of Christ, the deity of Christ. "It's the deity of Christ that divides us," he wrote in his diary. "Their sneers are much harder to bear than the stones the boys throw, though both are an honour of which I'm not worthy." It wasn't, of course, all rejection. One day the head of all the military tribes of Persia called, a chief himself over 20,000 families, and after discussing, he said to Martin, "I suppose you think all of us are infidels." "Yes," he said, "all of you are infidels." The man was delighted and thanked him for his frankness. But there were some who were won over, just one or two. One fanatical opponent, after many arguments, was moved by Martin's patience in the face of insults. And just before Martin left, he admitted his error and never ceased to read the Persian New Testament he'd been given. But despite the seeming lack of result, Shiraz was the scene of his greatest achievement, because it was here the first Persian New Testament was completed, together with the Psalms, in February 1812. He engaged the finest penman to prepare two presentation copies for the Shah and the Crown Prince. It took 3 months, but they were beautiful, ornamented copies. Persia is renowned for its exquisite penmanship. And these were to be presented to the Shah and to his son. He knew that to reach the Shah, he must go northward to Tabriz, 700 miles to the north, where the British ambassador was, because only through him could he gain audience with the Shah. But he left behind at Shiraz a small group of serious inquirers who, the nearer the date of his departure drew, their attention to the word and their loving attention to me, he said, seemed to increase daily. "Only God knows," he said, those who are his. But evidently he must have left a group of believers behind him. Shiraz had been healthy for him. He was much fitter by the time he left, though still an invalid. And by June the 8th he reached Tehran, halfway to Tabriz. I don't know how you pronounce it. It's still the center of Persia today. There he made his approach to the... He knew that ultimately Tabriz was the place where the ambassador was, but he learned when he got to Tehran that the Shah was on holiday, if you call it a holiday, at his summer camp very, very close to that city. And so he decided that rather than go all the distance northward, he would endeavour himself. Using a letter of introduction from Sir John Malcolm, via the Premier or the Prime Minister of Persia, he would see if he could get to see the Shah direct. So he made his approach to the Premier's office. Two secretaries of state discussed with him the Christian faith, and they were clearly impressed. And so he was encouraged to think that he would succeed. But then came the meeting with the premier himself. He found himself before a body of the most powerful mullahs or Muslim teachers in Persia. He presented his New Testament. The premier listened as for 2 hours heated discussion went on between the mullahs and Henry Martyn. They were the most ignorant and abusive mullahs he'd ever met. Finally, after 2 hours, the premier gave his verdict. "You had better say God is God and Muhammad is his prophet." Henry Martyn replied, "God is God and Jesus is the Son of God." At once they all rose up as if they would tear him in pieces. One of them said, "What will you say when your tongue is burned out for blasphemy?" They flung his New Testament on the ground. Henry Martyn got up. He had no fear for himself, but he was fearing that they'd trample on his precious New Testament. So he walked into the middle of them and picked it up and wrapped it in a towel, while they looked on with contempt. That night he received a message that he could only approach the Shah through the English ambassador. He must go on, therefore, to Tabriz after all. Well, it meant another month's travelling before he got to Tabriz. The terrain, the burning daytime heat, the piercing cold at night, shortage of food, poor accommodation took their toll. Again and again he writes, "I repeated, let patience have her perfect work, time and time and time again, and I pleaded constantly the promise, when thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee." Finally he reached the ambassador's house, more dead than alive. Fever and delirium had set in. Here the ambassador, a very gracious man, and his wife nursed him back to life, though hardly to health. The ambassador undertook that he himself would make the presentation to the Shah, and he was true to his word. He presented the New Testament. Martyn was too ill. The Shah was delighted. He issued his reply, "The translation is highly acceptable to our august mind. If it please the most merciful God, we shall command our most select servants to read us this book from beginning to end, that we may comprehend its contents. The second copy was presented to the Crown Prince, and the Shah's judgment was published all over the world among his people. Soon 5 editions were in print. And the work that Henry Martyn had hoped to do was now successful. But now he had other objectives. The Arabic New Testament, well, he realized that he couldn't possibly do that till he was stronger. And he felt it would be necessary for him to return to England, to recover health, and then return to do the Arabic New Testament. So he wrote to Charles Simeon and to Lydia, and then he set out for England via Constantinople, that is, a journey to the northwest, which you can see begins from Tabriz and ends at Tokat. What he was purposing to do would have involved a journey of 1,300 miles on horseback, with letters of introduction from the ambassador. It was equivalent to the whole length of modern Turkey. At first his journey went well, and then once again illness set in. The convoy was led by a Tartar, Hassan, and now that Martyn was ill, he took control. He had no pity or sympathy for Martyn's condition. At every inn, he had the best food and accommodation. Henry Martyn was left in the stable with the leftovers of the food. He was helpless. In his journal, he writes, my fever increased. The heat in my forehead made the warmth of the fire unbearable. I begged them either to put it out or move me elsewhere. They ignored me. So I pushed my head among the luggage and lay on the damp ground. Next day I was in a palsy, my teeth chattering, my frame shaking. Hassan sat with total indifference. That day there were no horses. I had an unexpected rest, and these were the last words he ever wrote. I sat in an orchard and thought with sweet comfort and peace of my God. In solitude, my company, my friend and comforter. Oh, when shall time give place to eternity? When shall appear that new heaven and earth wherein dwelleth righteousness? Those were the last words he wrote. Following day, the journey went on. Hassan, unfeeling as ever, hustled the dying man as far as he could, but not for long. Somewhere at Tokat, in northern Turkey, he was buried on the 16th of October, 1812. No Christian near to mourn him, no monument to mark the spot. No, he died unknown, but his work was done. One would think little had been achieved, but what did he leave behind? He left a few souls saved in each place where he labored. But he left two New Testament translations that have brought the gospel to countless millions, his Hindustani New Testament and his Persian New Testament. And he left his diary. He had meant it to be destroyed, but it is precious reading, a life of rare sacrifice and self-denial. In it he had written, "I was born to suffer. Let this reconcile me to everything. To have a will of my own, which is not God's will, is the most tremendous wickedness, and his will is our sanctification." And so the man who at Cambridge never lost an hour in pursuit of maths, never lost an hour in the service of Christ. He only lived 31 years. He was only a Christian for 12. But the record of his life has moved countless Christians to greater devotion, and that is his message, I think, that you and I can take tonight. Charles Simeon, his spiritual father, hung his portrait over the fireplace. It was painted in Calcutta just before he left for Persia. There were no photos in those days. And he would show it to people, and he would say, "Do you see that blessed man? Nobody looks at me as he does. He never takes his eyes off me. He always seems to be saying to me, 'Be serious, be in earnest, don't trifle, don't trifle.'" And Simeon would reply with a smile, would add with a smile, "And I won't trifle, I won't trifle." And perhaps that is something that we could take to encourage us in our devotion.